First of all, obviously, because this is the 21st century, I'm not sure if everyone knows this, but like the golden rule of the 21st century, even if you have a full-time job, you need a side gig. You need some other form of income. So I'm really excited to announce I'm launching a new range of sleep aids. If you are struggling to fall asleep at night or any other time of the day, the research on rabbinic literature, boy, that will knock you out. And so for a low, low price, I am happy to send you all the possible articles you could ever want to read on this topic, because over the past month, 6 weeks that I've been reading this stuff, I don't actually want to admit, like, I have genuinely fallen asleep many times. This past Monday morning was I think genuinely the first time I was at, because it was a Monday morning and the caffeine was rolling through me, I was able to make my way through an entire thing without dozing off. But Shabbos afternoons, which is usually my kind of like reading time, not good, not good. But it's the truth is, it's fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating. It's just how they get there is very, very boring. So it's just there you go. So I want to begin. While I shamefully catch my breath, by just recapping what we talked about last week, which was the origins of the rabbinic movement. As we talked about in a nutshell, during the Second Temple period, where there was tremendous sectarianism, you had the Prushim, the Pharisees, and they were a small group, a chabura, literally an association, like a little clique, a little group, a little, whatever. And their big belief was that the sanctity of the Beit HaMikdash extended into regular life. And this led to them, Purushim, this led to them being kind of separating themselves somewhat from everyone else. This notion of sanctity led to them being very focused on concepts such as ma'aser, tithing, somewhat of an obsession with tuma and tahara, purity and impurity. And this group, this very small group of people, what happens with the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash is a major point, obviously, of Jewish history, because not only is it the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, but it is also the Beit HaMikdash was the source of so much sectarian debate. You had the Tzedokim, the Sadducees, who loved the Beit HaMikdash because they were in control of it. Then you basically had everyone else who was dissatisfied in it for one reason or another. With the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, it does not bring the end of sectarianism, but it basically, the fuel for sectarian infighting starts to basically go away. And there's not the same fuel to fuel these fights. And basically, the Prushim, these Pharisees, to a certain extent, they rebrand themselves. As I talked about last week, they want to focus less on their sectarian infighting. They start to use a generic term, Rav, Rabbi, Rabbi, to kind of identify themselves, which just means it's a generic term for leader. That's all. And they get to what we're going to talk about today, which is their major project, which is formalizing Torah Sheba Alpeh, formalizing the oral law into how we basically start to see it, how we see it nowadays. And this is where there's a really important thing for us to focus on from the beginning. Just one second. It's really important to talk about Torah Sheba Alpeh, and really what we're going to be doing for most of this is talking about what exactly Torah Sheba Alpeh is. Because as Orthodox Jews, we recognize its supremacy, its significance, but we don't really get exactly what it is. We get what it is after the fact. We can kind of point at the Gemaras and be like, we know this is, the oral law in written form, but look, we believe, and it is a principle of our belief that not just the written Torah Shebechtav was given at Har Sinai, but also God gave Moshe Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral law. But what exactly does it mean? Because I don't think there's anyone on this call who believes that what that meant was, God gave Moshe a set of shas. He gave him like the Talmud. But there are definitely people who do believe that, but I don't. It's not a plausible belief, But at the same time, what exactly is it? what exactly is this Torah Sheba Al Peh? There are those who argue, there are those who believe, that Torah Sheba Al Peh was basically, you know, made up. Because the casual person's familiarity with Torah Sheba Al Peh begins with the Mishnah, which we'll start talking about next week. And so it seems like, oh, you have all of these laws in the Torah, and then you have all of these laws in the Mishnah, and there's not a one-to-one correspondence. And so it must be that Chazal, you know, made all this, you know, stuff up. And basically, I'll just make it very clear, that's also not true, as we will see. But it becomes very hard to try and identify what exactly Torah Sheba Al Peh is. When scholars over the past couple of centuries have attempted to define it, their own biases often get in the way. So it's no surprise that quote-unquote from scholars, you know, will find evidence for Torah Sheba Al Peh going back as far as possible. And it's no coincidence that irreligious scholars who are nonetheless interested in this will argue that Chazal kind of made all this stuff up and try to prove that. The situation, obviously, in reality, it's just very, very complicated. It's very hard to actually grasp exactly what Torah Sheba Al Peh is. But there is a needle that we can thread here. And so I want to begin by looking at some, I would say, clear examples of what we consider to be Torah Sheba Al Peh, what we consider to be the Chazal's domain, that actually come up far earlier. They come up in Tanakh itself. So I'm gonna share the source sheet at this point, so everyone can hopefully see the source sheet. And I want to begin with one of my favorite examples of this. Source number one, Parashat Vayishlach. The Torah tells us the following. Yaakov crosses the river, Vayivater Yaakov levado, he's left alone. Vayeovek ish imo, and a man wrestled with him. Ad alot hashachar, until the break of dawn. Now everyone knows, it's not a man here, but an angel. And the reason is, let's be honest, the reason is because the Oshol Stone Chumash says that in its commentary, but we'd all assume, we'd all take bets, the reason we identify it as an angel and not a man is Midrash, it's Chazal. But it's not true. It's the prophet Hosea, source number two. Ba'beten akav et achiv, and in the womb, he's talking about Yaakov, he tried to supplant his brother. Uv ono sara et Elohim, he fought with a divine being as an adult. Vayasar el malach vayuchal, he strove with an angel and prevailed. Bacha vayitchanen lo, beit elzim yimtzaenu v'sham yidaber imanu. He continues. Hosea himself, the prophet Hosea, now is not the time to get into what exactly prophecy is. Yeah, that's like the one question that's harder than what exactly Torah Sheba Al Peh is. But it's very obvious. Chazal did not make up the idea. They did not make up this association as the man of Yaakov, who Yaakov fights, being an angel. It's a prophecy that already starts to associate it. Okay, that's an example of what we call agada. That's an example of kind of, that's a legend, that's a story, that's an elaboration, cool. But we also see examples of this in halacha. Sources number three and four. Parashat Bo, talking about Pesach. The Korban Pesach, the special sacrifice that was eaten. Source number three says, Al tochlu mimenu na, you can't eat it raw. Uvashel mevushal b'mayim, nor can you eat it cooked in water. Ki in tzliyesha, has to be roasted. Rosho al kra'av of al kibra, all of it needs to be roasted. Bishul is almost always, the term bishul is actually using a liquid medium to cook something, in contrast to, say, roasting. But it's very clear, source number three, the Torah says you cannot cook the Korban Pesach. And yet source number four says, uvishalta v'achalta. Sefer Devarim, Parashat Re'eh, says, cook it and eat it. The place God chooses. And then you go home. What? I mean, this is standard Torah contradiction. And the truth is, usually how we understand these contradictions in the Torah is this is the grist for the mill of Chazal. This is a feature, not a bug. This is what Chazal did continually was resolve contradictions in the Torah. Don't worry. These two verses don't actually contradict one another. They don't conflict with one another. They can be read in a complementary way. And so we'd assume Chazal, open a Gemara somewhere, you will find a, you know, these two verses being read in a way that doesn't put them at tension anymore. But the truth is Divrei Hayamim does that. Source number five. So Divrei Hayamim, the Book of Chronicles, is a Second Temple work. It's one of the latest additions to Tanakh. So during the probably early Bayit Sheni period, it goes through the entirety of Jewish history and up until its point. It has a whole bunch of interesting takes on a lot of things. How does it frame Korban Pesach? Vashlu ha-Pesach bo'esh kamishpat. They cooked it in fire as prescribed. They basically reinterpret this word bishul, which usually means a liquid medium. No, they see it as almost a generic term for just cooking. Vayivashlu ha-pesach ba'esh, cooking it in fire. That's really roasting. Source four is not contradicting source three. It's just using a less specific term. Source number three is the specific term. Don't cook in water. Use, you know, roast it. And source four is a less specific term resolved by source number five. We also saw last week in the shir, and I didn't want to put it on the source sheet again because there's only so many weeks in a row. I want to put the Christian Bible on a source sheet. But we saw last week, the book of Luke testifies to the fact that Jews were washing their hands. They were doing the Tilat Yadayim, a practice that doesn't really have anything in the Torah. But nonetheless, it's clearly a tradition. It's clearly a custom. It's clearly a practice that predates the rabbinic era. Whatever exactly Torah Sheba Alpeh is, whatever exactly Torah Sheba Alpeh was before it was formalized by Chazal, it clearly existed in some form or another. That much is clear. And just another great example, and please God, at some point we'll have a Shir series on this in the run-up to Pesach. The Seder is honestly a wonderful example of this. Again, you look at how the Torah tells you to celebrate Pesach, and then you look at how Chazal tell you to celebrate Pesach. There's a lot added in. But if you look through the literature of the Bayit Sheni period, if you look through the literature of the Second Temple period, you'll start to see some of these other elements already added in, some of these elements already being observed with Jews. It's clear that there was some additional traditions, some additional laws, some particular understandings of how Jews should function already long before Chazal came on the scene and started giving explicit instructions on what to do. The major thing to just realize here, though, is that while the Beit HaMikdash stood, these additional traditions, these additional ways of observing Judaism were somewhat self-perpetuating. At the end of the day, people could observe, live their Jewish lives however they could. And I'm sure that there were probably vast differences in what exactly everyone was doing, because ultimately the fundamental center of Jewish life was the Beit HaMikdash. When you have an institution, and you have kind of institutionalized practices, that becomes like the heartbeat of everything. But the problem is, when that's destroyed, you're unsure where to go. You don't know exactly what to start doing after that. And this is the rabbinic project. This is what the rabbis set out to do. Formalize the process. In a sense, the institution ceases to be the Beit HaMikdash after it's destroyed. The institution becomes the law. What will continue to, you know, to kind of paraphrase Golda Meir's phrase, more than the Jews have kept Shabbat, Shabbat has kept the Jews. So you could kind of paraphrase that, more than the Jews have kept Halacha, Halacha has made the Jews Jews. That is, in the absence of the Beit HaMikdash, you need something else to revolve around. And that becomes the formalization of the oral law. I also imagine it was easiest for the Prushim, for the Pharisees, to be the ones to take on this project, because they believed the sanctity of the Beit HaMikdash extended into everyday life. The Tzedokim, the Sadducees, for whom everything revolved around the Beit HaMikdash, once that's destroyed, they don't really have anywhere to go. But if you already believe temple sanctity extends beyond the temple, it is easier to argue we can continue our lives without it. However traumatic that is, we can continue our lives. And so the rabbinic movement turns to formalizing the oral law. Now, the best analogy for this, the best way to ultimately understand what Chazal did in broad strokes, it is to use an analogy that no one will appreciate, but there you go. And it is the Football Association of England. You call it soccer, I call it football. How did that sport become a sport? And it's true of all sports. It's the same as like the Victorians and tennis. There was this game that was being played in schools throughout the country. And there were a whole different set of rules depending on the schools. Because it was kind of local, people did whatever they did. In a world without kind of mass communication, it's just people do whatever they want. And then along come this group of people who are somewhat self-appointed. And they decide, we are going to formalize the rules of the game. We are actually now going to gather together and make this sport a more formal thing. We are going to make it into something with rules. And this is a defining moment, because when you decide to make the rules to a sport, for example, that has otherwise been organically defined, a few things happen. First, you get breakaway sports. So the sport of rugby is named after the school in Rugby, which is a town, because they basically didn't like all of these new rules. They wanted to still use their hands. They wanted to still smash into each other. And so they broke away and formed their own sport. But the other thing is you start to standardize. You start to create a far more uniform set of rules as you kind of create the rules of the game. You also start to ask yourself a lot of questions. Okay, so these people do this, these people do that. Which one is the correct one? We have to decide. We have to make a decision. As you start to ask these questions, more issues, more rules need to be decided. And so basically, that's what Chazal did. It's a very complex period of time. But what essentially the rabbinic project is to take the already existing traditions, already existing practices, already existing laws, and try to break through and come up with a unifying set of laws. Maybe, you know, in place X, they say bracha A on a given food item, whereas in place Y, they say bracha B on a given food item. We need to standardize. We need to come up with a rule as to which bracha it is. Maybe one group of people think you can, you know, do one thing. Another group of people think you can do another. We have to decide, is this something we're going to legislate? And so basically that's the process of creating Torah Sheba Al Peh. That's essentially what starts happening. That's what Chazal set out to do. And so the very first venue, the very first format that Chazal seek to create, to formalize this oral law, is a literature known as Midrashei Halacha. And so the term, so I will admit, by the way, I have always been daunted by Midrashei Halacha because I never really understood what it was. And I knew I had to because it's kind of the missing link of my own knowledge. So I finally, after several false starts and several unintentional naps, got to grips to understand what exactly Midrashei Halacha was. But we're familiar with the concept of Midrashim. And Midrashim, we usually think are what we'd call Midrashei Agada. They elaborate, they extend the story. Sometimes they make the stories in the Torah more black and white. Sometimes they do one thing versus another. Midrashei Halacha is something very different. Because if you were to think of the first port of call for creating and codifying and systematizing the oral law, the most obvious choice would be the Torah. It makes sense to go through the laws of the Torah and say, oh, this pasuk says X. Oh, from this pasuk, we learn 15 other, you know, additional laws. And that is exactly what Midrashe Halacha do. There's obviously no Midrash Halacha on Bereshit because there's basically no laws in Bereshit, and the laws that exist are repeated elsewhere. Midrashe Halacha exist on Shmot Vayikra Bamidbar Dvarim. The truth is there were probably a lot more Midrashe Halacha out there back in the day than we have now, because for reasons that will become clear by the end of this year and also next week, Midrash Halacha ceased to be the most useful form, the most useful written text of, it wasn't probably written at the beginning, but it seems to be the most useful way of kind of exploring Torah Sheba Alper. But Midrashe Halacha were the first way of doing things. And so I want to once again, there are some really important questions before we start talking about Midrashe Halacha, which is, when Chazal say X, verse X gives us the following laws, is it truly emerging from that law, or are they just looking for a verse to hang it on? So when the Torah says, we saw this with the Shir on Pesach, you know, oh, the Torah says you can't eat chametz. Obvious. It literally says it. But Chazal also learned out you can't derive benefit from chametz. Well, is that actually emerging from the verse somehow or another, or is it, alternatively, they knew, be it either a tradition or they wanted to institute the practice of forbidding benefit from chametz too. So did they just hang that principle on the prohibition of eating chametz? That is a major question often asked. Does it truly emerge from a verse, or is it merely we're using this verse as a convenient way to explore this law? And second, and especially with rabbinic laws, are Chazal really just formalizing existing traditions, harmonizing existing traditions, or are they kind of making stuff up is the wrong term, but are they adding stuff? The answer is yes to everything, because that's the reality of formalizing laws. When you set out to create a system, you end up adding more and more, and it does become pretty fluid in what explicitly emerges from the text versus what is kind of hung on the text, what was a tradition clearly before Chazal stepped onto the scene, versus what were things, obviously by their very term, rabbinic laws, there are some things that we acknowledge Chazal themselves instituted. But the truth is, Chazal themselves were very self-aware of this. And one of my favorite, one of the best known and most fascinating Mishnayot, and it says source number 8 in the English, but it's source number 6, is the Mishnah in Chagiga. It's an absolutely fascinating Mishnah. You could give Shi'urim upon Shi'urim upon Shi'urim just on this Mishnah. It says the following. Heter Nedarim, the laws of annulling vows. Parchim Ba'avir, they fly around. Ve'en lahem al masha yismuchu. There's nothing to support them. There is no verse. There is nothing whatsoever in the Torah that validates the notion of Heter Nedarim, annulling vows. Hilchot Shabbat, the laws of Shabbat, Chagigot v'hameilot, the special Chagiga, the offering that was given on the Chagim, on the festivals, Me'ila, the prohibition of using misusing consecrated property, Harei Heim Kahararim Hatiluyim B'Sa'ara, they are like mountains suspended by a hair. Shehein Mikra Mu'at v'halachot Merubot, for they have very few verses in the Torah, but a tremendous number of halachot. If you think of Hilchot Shabbat, and at the end of the day, we learn it from the Mishkan, we learn it from the construction of the tabernacle. There's and Hashem says, you know, keep Shabbat, don't do the following things on it. But like, that's what we learn everything about Shabbat from. And then finally, Hadinin v'ha'avodot, Hataharot v'hatumot v'ha'arayot, monetary law, the avoda of the Beit HaMikdash, the sacrificial rites, the concepts of purity and impurity, and also the prohibited sexual relations, which we read about in last week's parasha. Yesh lahen al masha yisnuchu, they have what to be based upon. Hein hein gufei Torah, they're essential parts of Torah. Chazal was self-aware. It's fascinating. Chazal was self-aware of what they themselves were instituting. They aren't delegitimizing the importance of Hilchot Shabbat, but they are recognizing that a large chunk of Jewish observance hinges upon oral law, hinges upon Torah Sheba Alpeh, out of which there is very little explicit verses to kind of understand things from. There's also, you know, there's a common term used in a lot of commentaries, an asmachta, which means a scriptural allusion. So let's say, I'm actually going to be quoting it in this coming Shabbat's drasha, the source of why we need to give the Kohen the first aliyah. Because, you know, Hashem says the Kohanim are kadosh, and which Rabbi Yishmael learns to be, means you have to treat them, give them the first of everything. And a lot of commentators are like, that's an asmachta. That verse, treat the Kohen holy, does not actually mean give the Kohen the first aliyah, but rather Chazal saw a value in giving Kohanim respect, that they rooted, that they anchored in this notion, this ethic of the holiness of Kohanim, but it doesn't explicitly emerge from the Torah. And so this question is a much larger question. But it's important to realize, again, Chazal, they didn't make this stuff up. Generally speaking, it's based off something predating them. And second, they were incredibly self-aware. They weren't trying to pull, if the wool is over anyone's eyes, it's only because no one's read that Mishnah in Chagiga, and Chazal want you to read that Mishnah in Chagiga. They tell you to read that Mishnah in Chagiga. You read it and you're like, I remember the first time I encountered this Mishnah, I was like, wow, this is just incredible. I was just struck by the self-awareness. So it's something worth noting. Back to Midrashei Halacha. The whole concept behind Midrashei Halacha is not just deriving laws via verses, but through using what are called hermeneutic principles or rules of exposition. The very first person to do this is Hillel, who, as we noted last week, is a Pharisee, not technically a rabbi. The Sifra says, Sifra is a Midrash Halacha, source number 7, and it's actually repeated, a lot of different rabbinic literature repeats this. Hillel hazaken darash sheva midot lifnei ziknei b'teira. So Hillel the elder expounded 7 different exegetical methods before the elders of b'teira. The first is a kal v'chomer. I'm not going to explain what each one of these is because some of them, honestly, I get confused unless I have it written down in front of me, and I forgot to write it down in front of me. These are just basically all principles of deriving laws. The first is the Kal V'chomer, the second is the Gezeirah Shavah, the third is the Binyan Av, the fourth is the principle of Shnei Ketuvim, the fifth is Klalu Prat, the sixth is Kiyotze Bo B'Makom Acher, and the seventh is V'dava Lamed Me'inyano, and then the Sifra repeats, this is what Hillel the Elder instituted. These 7 rules. So just to take the Gezeirah Shavah, the analogy. The Gezeirah Shavah notes, if 2 verses have similar phrasing within them, then what this means is that those 2 laws should be treated the same. Now, as is, so, you know, sometimes we look at Gezeirah Shavahs and it seems ridiculous. My Rebbe likes to point out he's really a grammarian. Usually there is a more grammatical rationale behind seeing these 2 words as the same. There's a context. There's some Chazal knew how to read Tanakh. We don't. But they really, so some of these often it's noting actually very subtle aspects of the grammar of the Torah that gives these rules of exposition. Hillel is the first. Perhaps the best known expositor of Midrash Halacha, and best known because it's that thing all of us pretend to say every morning in Shacharit, Rabbi Yishmael. What do we say at the end of kind of, you know, the early brachot? We read a passage from the Sifra, Rabbi Yishmael, Aimer, Bishlosh Esrei Midot, HaTorah Nidrashit Bahen, is usually what it says in the Siddur. Rabbi Yishmael says there are 13 exegetical principles the Torah is expounded. And then the list of 13, that again, they're tongue twisters, all of them. And, you know, I want to say the art school commentary kind of explains what each one is. And if you've ever tried to do that, another remedy for you know, insomnia. But basically, what's important to note here, by the way, Rabbi Yishmael's 13 are not just 6 more on top of Hillel, a lot of them are actually far more nuanced and they are far more complex. And Rebbe Yishmael is one of the two major schools of Midrash Halacha. Rebbe Yishmael is. And you will often read in Gemara, and we'll see this in a second. I'll give one example where this comes up in the Gemara. The Tana debate Rebbe Yishmael, it was taught in the Beit Midrash, in the school of Rebbe Yishmael. Rebbe Yishmael is Mr. Midrash Halacha. He is one of the two major schools of thought, and he is the person with these 13 rules of exposition out of which he derives so much of the oral law. His school's responsible for what's called the Mechilta, the Rebbe Yishmael. No shock there, it has his name on it. That's on Sefer Shmot. And we also have the Sifrei. So you see source number 8 is from the Sifra. No, the Sifrei. Very similar names. The Sifrei, which is on Bamidbar and Devarim, is also Rebbe Yishmael. It is almost undeniable that Rebbe Yishmael, his school must have authored something on Sefer Vayikra, but we don't have it. The other major figure of Midrash Halacha, and it is makes it appropriate given this week is the week of kind of Lag BaOmer, is Rebbe Akiva. Yeah, it was just, you know, singing. He'd learned in school lots of Rebbe Akiva songs as he was, you know, not falling asleep. You know, this is the week where we focus a lot on Rebbe Akiva. One thing we probably don't necessarily associate Rebbe Akiva with is Midrash Halacha. But actually we do, because if you just think of, like, there are lots of stories we talk about Rebbe Akiva, how he would read into even the crowns on the letters he would expound. If you ever heard any of these kinds of stories about Rebbe Akiva, what Chazal are grasping at is the fact that Rebbe Akiva was the other Mr. Expositor of the Torah. He was the other Midrash Halacha. He went through the Torah. Oh, we learn this from that. We learn this from that. We learn this from that. And he has far fewer. He uses a lot of these, you know, hermeneutical principles. He uses a lot of these rules. But one of the big defining features of Rebbe Akiva is incredible close reading of the words themselves. And I'm going to show you an example of this in a second. But the best known products of Rebbe Akiva is the Sifra, Torat Kohanim, which is a midrash on Sefer Vayikra, which derives all of the various oral laws from Sefer Vayikra, and also the Mechilta de Rebbe Shimon, Rabban Shimon Bar Yochai. Again, it's coming up to Lag BaOmer. Rabban Shimon Bar Yochai was one of the major students of Rebbe Akiva. He was one of the major expositors of Rebbe Akiva's Torah. Fascinatingly, and this is something we will also talk about next week, we don't realize how often Rebbe Akiva himself is quoted or is stated in rabbinic literature, because often it's quoted in the names of his students. But basically, put aside the whole Kabbalah stuff, we're not getting into that. But basically, everything said by Rabban Shimon Bar Yochai is Rebbe Akiva. And so the Mechilta to Rebbe Shimon Bar Yochai is actually Rebbe Akiva's Midrash Halacha. Just his, it's like nowadays, take like Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik didn't write a lot of Sefarim, but his students do. So it's like sometimes his students are credited with the type, with like, they're the authors of this work, but everyone knows who it really comes from. Same with Mechilta de Rebbe Shimon Bar Yochai. One of the really cool things is how, and it's been a project over the past couple of centuries, identifying the Midrashei Halacha, whether they belong to Rebbe Akiva and Rebbe Yishmael. And there's a few different ways. One is the terms used. They each use similar but different terms, which first of all reveals which school it comes from. The language, the people mentioned, is a really, really big one. Even though Rebbe Akiva is mentioned in Rebbe Yishmael's Midrashei Halacha, and Rebbe Yishmael is mentioned in Rebbe Akiva's Midrashei Halacha, guess who is always the correct one? The one who's the author of the work, the one who's the school is. So you look at the names. My favorite example of this is a really cool example. So Rebbe Shimon Bar Yochai, in Rebbe Akiva Midrashei Halacha, he's just Reb Shimon. Because everyone knew who Rebbe Shimon was. He was the prime student of Rebbe Akiva. But in Rebbe Yishmael, you know, Midrashei Halacha, he's Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, because he needs to be defined. It's like nowadays, again, you get up in a modern Orthodox shul in America and you talk about the Rav, everyone knows you're talking about Rav Soloveitcher. You don't need to qualify it. In Israel, in a religious Zionist place, someone gets up and talks about HaRav, they mean Rav Cook. It's the same idea. Rabbi Shimon, in Rabbi Akiva's world, everyone knew who Rabbi Shimon was. But in Rabbi Yishmael's world, he needed the last name. In the modern Orthodox world, everyone knows who the Rav is, but you go to other communities and you have to say Rav Soloveitchik, because you have to clarify, because every community has its Rav. It's the same idea. So what I want to show is a really fascinating example of Rabbi Yishmael and Rabbi Akiva in action. And it's not an exciting example, but it comes from our parasha this coming week, which makes it interesting. So we will read. The beginning of Parashat Emor is various laws of Kohanim. Source number 9 says the following. Uvat ish Kohen, the daughter of a Kohen, kitechel liznot. She defiles herself through harlotry. Et aviha hi mechalelet. She's disgraced her father. She's defiled him. Bo'esh tisareif, burn her in fire. Not getting into the, you know, grappling with the fact that that seems, you know, nowadays to our modern sensibilities, we're like, did that just say burn? But put all that aside, the important, you know, it's a halacha. The Gemara in Sanhedrin says the following. My Rabbi Yishmael, what is the source of Rabbi Yishmael's view? Source number 10, Detanya. As we learn, Uvat ish kohen kitechel liznot, b'na'ara, v'hi arusa hakatuv medaba, that this was only talking about a young woman who is betrothed. She, in that specific situation, is executed by burning, but a married woman does not get the punishment prescribed in the Torah, but instead is executed through stoning. So there's already a lot, I just gave you a lot of information dump, but basically you can kind of define from a marriage perspective and a marriage halachic perspective, three possible, you know, states for a woman. There is a married woman when it comes to, you know, there's a married woman, there is a single woman, and then there is the period of erusin. We translate that as betrothal. It's not a good translation, but it's good enough for our purposes. She's not yet married, but she's no longer single. So Rabbi Yishmael says that when the Torah says in verse 9 that the daughter of a Kohen who commits an act of harlotry must be burned, that's talking about a very specific situation, a betrothed woman rather than a married woman. If a married woman were to do it, she's executed in a different way. The third line of the Hebrew and the 6th line of the English, Rabbi Akiva Omer, achat arusa v'achat nesua yotzeit l'sorefa, both are burned. So we have a debate between these two giants, these two schools of Midrashei Halacha. Rabbi Yishmael restricts the burning to a very specific case. Rabbi Akiva burns everyone. Okay, so then in the ellipses, there's a whole debate back and forth. They talk about their various hermeneutical principles. They apply them, yada, yada, yada. Then things get really interesting here. Because remember, what did I say about Rabbi Akiva? He's obsessed with the words themselves. Amale Rabbi Akiva, Yishmael achi, Yishmael, my brother, bat uvat ani dorish. What does the Torah say in verse number 9? It could say bat ish kohen, the daughter of a kohen. What does it actually say? Uvat, and the daughter of a kohen. So don't ask me exactly what to explain that as, but the mere fact that it says uvat means it's including a broader category. It's not a restrictive category, like Rabbi Yishmael believes it to be. It's a broad category. Everyone gets burned, says Rabbi Akiva. Amar le, Rabbi Yishmael says an amazing response. V'chi mipnei she'ata doresh bat uvat notzei zo l'sreifa, you're going to burn her because of the vav? Like, it's a phenomenal line. Like Rabbi Akiva, you're going to execute this person by burning because of the extra vav in the Torah. Like that's the lengths you go to, you know, that's how you derive your law. There's an extra vav in there. And from that, we upscale the punishment of someone. Rabbi Yishmael doesn't understand it because he's strict about his hermeneutical principles. But for Rabbi Akiva, the Vav is significant. And this is a perfect encapsulation of Midrashei Halacha in action. I'm going to pause the source sheet because we're done with sources, but there's a few other things, there's a bit more to say. Midrashei Halacha are all about obsessing over the verses, reading the verses carefully, by agreeing to a certain set of principles, by trying to compellingly argue that things emerge from the specific word choices of various verses. But it also creates a problem. Using the Torah as the bedrock of Torah Sheba Al-Peh is incredibly limiting. For starters, just think about the organization. The Torah is not organized. All of Shabbat is not put in one place. All of Pesach is not put in one place. So if you're going to explore the entirety of the laws of Pesach, where do you do it? It's going to be, all over the place. Second, it's really hard to formalize the oral law using the written law. It's really hard to anchor everything in verses. There are some things where it's too hard to do. It's too difficult to convince people that that every single aspect of the oral law emerges from hyper-nuanced readings of the verses. In a sense, when you anchor the oral law so strictly as Midrash Halacha does in written law, it ceases to be its own body. And it's purely a supporting act, or it's at least tied to, very strictly tied to the verses. And that's not what Torah Sheba Al-Peh is. It is supposed to be much bigger. It's a much more ambitious system. And so the project of Midrash Halacha, the reason why we don't have all the Midrashei Halacha is because they weren't very useful. They aren't very helpful. There are a whole host of reasons why Midrash Halacha ends up being an unhelpful source of the formal oral law. And so what you need instead is to reinvent the system entirely. You need to actually turn around and say, we are going to come up with an entirely new conceptualization of the oral law. We are going to give it its own categories. We are going to give it its own rules. We are going to use the Torah when we need to anchor something. But generally speaking, we're just going to roll with the oral law as is, because that's how these things work. And what that means is you're going to create the Mishnah. And so what we will talk about next week is how we go from formalizing Torah Sheba Al-Peh through the mechanics of the verses of the Torah themselves, which we saw tonight, and how instead we start to transition to the oral law as its own body, its own work. That is the Mishnah, and we will also talk about the Tosefta, and we will understand exactly what the Mishnah is, how it came to be, and what its prime purpose is, beginning next week.